Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Renee Powers here. I am your host today. I've got a great interview with Lovie Ajayi-Jones. I can't tell you how much I love this interview. In fact, my partner was working from home the day I recorded this, and he came in and said, "Who were you talking to? You were laughing a lot." This is an episode that you will want to keep in your back pocket as a pep talk when you need it, as something that's going to make you think and feel and laugh and just feel all the feelings. She goes into kind of behind the scenes of her viral TED Talk, you know, how her grandmother inspired so much of her career, and how writing this book differs from writing her first book. I think Lovie is such an icon, and if you're not following her on social media, what are you doing with your life? So I'm not going to say any more than that. Enjoy today's episode. Hi, everyone. I am sitting down with Lovie Ajayi-Jones. Lovie is a New York Times bestselling author, speaker, and podcast host who thrives at the intersection of comedy, media, and justice. She's an internationally recognized speaker who takes on dozens of stages every year around the globe and has spoken at some of the world's most innovative companies and conferences, including Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Twitter. She's also the co-creator of hashtag Share the Mic Now Global Movement and hosts her podcast, Professional Troublemaker. Her debut book, I'm Judging You, The Do Better Manual, was released to critical acclaim, hitting the New York Times bestselling list at number 5. And we're talking about her new book today, Professional Troublemaker, The Fear Fighter Manual, which drops March 2nd. So pre-order it right now. Welcome, Lovie.
Thank you for having me.
I am so thrilled to be chatting with you today. We ask all of our guests the same question right off the bat, and that is, what does it mean to you to be feminist?
Ooh, to be a feminist is to be a woman who can make the choices that are best for her life. It's to be a person who believes in the power of moving through the world, knowing that I can build the life that I want without obstacles that's based on what I look like, who I love, what I, you know, what deity I worship or not. So I think to be a feminist is to really value justice in the world for everybody.
Yes. And I love that your bio calls that out, that you thrive on justice, comedy, and media. And I love that trio of things. How does that definition of feminism then inform your work at the intersection of comedy, media, and justice?
Yes. It basically informs everything about me in that the work that I create, the person that I am, how I move through the world is with the hopes that I am, one, working towards a more just world, that I'm using my voice to help us get closer to it, that I'm using my life as a model of what it looks like to pick what you want to do, to basically move in a way that is really authentic to what you feel like moving like that day. And I'm hoping that the humor of it all allows people to pull down their defenses and hear what I'm saying. And I think humor is amazing. It's a really powerful tool, because when we make each other laugh, when we can make somebody else laugh, we establish common ground. So that is all really significant to what I am doing and how I want to show up and the impact I want to make.
Yes. Amen. Cosine. You have a very well-known TED Talk. And I heard echoes of your TED Talk in this book. How did that talk inspire this book? And also, it feels like your grandmother inspired this book quite a bit too. Can you talk a little bit about those inspirations?
Yeah, I feel like past me leaves breadcrumbs for future me often. Like, I'll notice that I just move by doing what I feel is natural and what I feel compelled to do. But then something will pop up from 5 years ago or 7 years ago that is literally something that is related to something else that I'm doing. And I'm like, oh, snap. Old me was doing these things, saying these things, being these things, prepping for current me. It's always fascinating because when I did my TED talk, I had no idea what my second book was going to be about, right? Like when that talk happened, that was November 2017 that I gave that talk. And I was asked to do the TED talk twice and I turned it down because I didn't think I was ready because I was afraid that I would bomb on that stage. I was afraid that I was too busy and didn't have enough time or practice to take that really serious stage. So I actually turned them down twice. And 3 weeks before TED, Pat Mitchell asked me again because I was like, oh, I can come support my friends and give, you know, I would just love a day pass. And she was like, if you can come, I want you to speak. And I was like, Pat, that's kind of crazy. It's 3 weeks before. I was about to send her this email that I was like, Pat, you know, thank you so much. I'm honored for the thought. I can't do this in 3 weeks because I would have to come up with a new talk. Everybody else has already had these things going. They've already had coaches. Their talks have already been rehearsed 45 times. Nah. And I was about to send that email again, the third time declining this. And I called one of my friends and I was like, yeah, they want me to do this TED talk, which is kind of crazy because it's 3 weeks away and everybody else has already had all this practice and is already prepared. And my friend literally was like, everybody's not you. Like, stop being afraid. Get off my phone, go write your talk. And when I gave that talk, mine was the first talk from that TED event that was featured because a month later, it was posted on TED.com and featured on the homepage. And within a month, it had 1 million views. And the reason the TED talk itself was significant is I talked about fear in it. I talked about the year that I turned 30, that I actually made it a point to do the things that scared me. And I talked about how it actually shifted my life. When it was time for me to come up with the idea for my second book, I was like, I'll know when I know. And I remember being like, wait a minute. Every single day I get an email from somebody, an email, a tag on social media from somebody who's like, I just watched your TED talk and it did this thing for me. It made this impact. Somebody actually commented on the TED video and said, my TED talk helped pull them out of their depression. And I remember being like, fear, that's the thing. Your life is a testament of all the times that you've done things, even when you were afraid. I did that TED talk petrified that I was going to bomb. You know, the year that I turned 30 and all the things that I talked about in the TED talk, I did so many things and ran towards the things that scared me on purpose, intentionally. And I saw how much it transformed my life because that year I got my first book deal. That book deal ended up having me write the first book, I'm Judging You, which became a New York Times bestseller, which allowed me to retire my mother. So I literally was like, my next book needs to focus on fear because I know how much it has transformed my life in the moments when I did not let fear stop me from doing what I needed to. And where my grandmother comes in is that, again, old me just like left maps for current me. The first words I said in my TED talk are, I'm a professional troublemaker. And being a professional troublemaker to me means that I always commit myself to doing what feels bigger than me, to not only disrupt the rooms I'm in, to disrupt myself for my greater good and for the greater good of the people around me. And a lot of that has come in doing what scared me. So I was on the way to a speaking engagement in Paris. And I remember I was about to get on the plane and it was one of those light bulb moments. And I was like, I come from a long line of professional troublemakers. My grandmother is one. And right then and there, I was like, the person who taught me to live this fearless life was my grandmother. She's the one I was watching this whole time. She's really the anchor and the person who I need to make sure I center in this book outside of myself. That's how this book came together for me. That moment when I was like, I literally took my page, because I always have a notebook with me. I got on the plane, I boarded, I sat down, strapped myself in, pulled my notebook out and just started writing instantly. And I was like, that's my book. And I called my book agent when I got back and I was like, I'm clear what my book needs to be about. I'm clear what I want to say. My goal is to help 1 million people, like empower 1 million people to fight their fear, because what would happen in our lives? How amazing would the world be if we all committed to doing something scary for the greater good, something that we felt compelled to do? So that is how this book came around.
Mm, I love that. And I love the stories about your grandma. And it just feels like there's so much of her in this book, and you're channeling so much of her too. She seemed like, it seems like she was an incredible, hilarious, vibrant woman. Yes. How could you not just be obsessed with her?
Yes, that's exactly it. And, you know, I hope when people are reading the stories of her that they feel like they're meeting her.
Yeah.
For me, it's basically a big honor of my life to be able to write a book dedicated to my grandmother. And again, I didn't realize what the time, how perfect the timing would be. My book comes out March 2nd. My grandmother passed away May 1st, 2011. So it's 10 years since she passed. So this is the ultimate tribute. And it wasn't until I finished writing the book that I was like, oh, snap, this book is actually going to come out year 10 after she died. So I feel like it is the universe conspiring to really make this the perfect book to honor her legacy. And hopefully, I'm hoping that her legacy inspires other people to build really big legacies themselves.
For sure. You structure this book in three sections: be, do, and say. Can you talk about why you chose the structure for your book and what those three verbs mean for you?
Yes, it was important for me to put it in be, say, do, because for us to start fighting fear, for us to live a life that's bigger than what we could have thought about, you first have to fix some things in what you believe. And honestly, like a big part, you know, we hear it a lot. We hear it a lot that's like, mindset is everything. You know, the things that you actually think are possible for you become possible. And I saw it, like I see it. And I test it out even sometimes just to be like, you know what, let's see how audacious I could be sometimes and see if people follow along. And when I am audacious, the world follows me. Mm-hmm. So it's important to start with fixing and knowing what limiting things that we believe, right? And I'm always like, you know what? Even if you don't believe the big things, trick yourself into thinking you believe it. You know what I mean? Like, yes. You know, sometimes you got to trick yourself and then it'll fall into place. So be. And then once you are working on the be and you get that together, then now you got to start putting words to it, right? You got to start verbalizing these thoughts, these ideas, these dreams. You know, you got to start, you know, learning how to say the thing that might even scare you, right? And say the thing that might be uncomfortable. And then after that, the words don't mean much if you don't put action in it. And that's where do comes in. Now, put foot to the pavement, right? Now, walk it through and hopefully see it materialize. So that's why the be, say, do was organized in that order. And I feel like it's chronological also.
Yeah. One of the big fears that a lot of us have is fear of failure.
Yeah.
And you suggest that we fail loudly. Love that phrase. What does that mean to you? And do you have any advice for bouncing back? I just recently failed pretty loudly. And so, I mean, this is a very personal question for me. And so I would love just your kind of approach to failing loudly. What does it mean? And how do you bounce back?
Yeah, a big part of why we're afraid to go after something is because we don't want to fall flat in front of our faces. Not just that, we don't want to fall flat in front of our faces, like on our faces in front of other people, because that's embarrassing. That's humiliating. So then we're afraid to do anything because we're just like, here's the thing. Do everything you can to not fall flat on your face, but just know that's not going to be what stops you from falling flat on your face. Actually, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it. It's going to happen, right? So you can mitigate risk, but it's still going to happen one way or the other. How you bounce back from it, honestly, stay down for a hot second. Listen, feel the feelings, feel the humiliation, let it hurt your feelings. Stay down for a second, as opposed to trying to like pop back up, right? And just move past the moment. No, stay down for a hot second. Let it hit your spirit, because you have to feel the fail. You have to feel it. Because if you don't feel it, because we are all stubborn humans, we don't just change and grow because we're like, oh, it's a Monday, I'm going to grow today. No. we usually learn lessons from our failures. You don't learn lessons from your wins. You really don't. Like, you're like, oh, I already knew what to do. That's why I won. You learn lessons when you fail. So in those moments, once you get up slowly, right? Dust yourself off a little bit. You're still going to feel some bruises, right? Because it's still going to hurt a little. There's going to be some aftermarks on you, some scars on you. Then you now have to figure out, all right, what was I supposed to learn from that? What allows that face plant to not be for naught? What did I actually do that caused the face plant that I did not see coming? Because most of the time when we fall flat on our faces, because we don't see it coming. Right. We run it through all our regular filters. We run it through the things that we know. Typically, when we fail, it's because there's something else that we needed to learn that we didn't know yet. So in those moments of failure, you just got to be like, all right, clearly I missed something. What didn't I know? What was I supposed to learn? You will pick up something that will now allow you to be better than you were, because you won't make that mistake again. If you make the same mistake again, you're going to actually have the same fail. You'll keep learning the same lesson, right? Until you actually absorb it. So I'm always like, okay, the moment, the storm, in the storm, it's hard to learn. So don't expect yourself to necessarily learn in the storm, because you're still all in your feelings. Your ego's hurt. You still like can't even deal. You just think everybody's trash, which is fine. Everybody can be trash. It's after you dust yourself off a little bit, give yourself some space, then figure out what you were supposed to learn, and then be gentle with yourself and say, okay, I was operating off what I didn't know. And now I know better. Like Maya Angelou said, when you know better, you do better. Then you, the next thing you do is you now do better. And it's a process. It is not an easy thing. It is usually an ego burst, like it's a punch to your face. But honestly, you grow from it if you are somebody who is willing to grow from it. If you're somebody who's just like, everybody is against me, you won't learn. You'll make the same mistake again. It's going to hurt even worse the second time. And then you're back to stage one. So yeah, fail loudly, yo. It's just know it is a rite of passage. Mm-hmm. It is a rite of passage for anybody who is existing in this world, who wants to be of note. Failure is a rite of passage, because I'm telling you, the people who have never failed, never face planted, are people whose names you will never know. Are people who haven't really touched anybody's lives. They don't want to offend anybody. But you know what happens when you constantly try not to offend anybody? You're also not affirming anybody. Mm. You're also not being a person of impact. So if you want to be the person who's just like, I just want everybody to like me, it means nobody will love you. Nobody will hate you, but nobody will love you, where they're like, hey, I will fight for you, because you're living this really tepid, mediocre life and doing nothing of note. It means you will make no big impact. You would just be the medium person. They're so nice. Okay, what else about them? They're just really nice. Okay, what else can you tell me about them? So just failure is a rite of passage. We all got to do it. We all will do it. We all will continue to do it. But each time it takes us to somewhere greater that we weren't going to go unless we did that thing.
And what I love so much about this book is you're not speaking about this as kind of an abstract thing. You share your loud failures with us and what you learned from it and the process going through it. And it was so affirming to me to see someone just own it. Like, this is how I fucked up. And this is the kind of falling out of it and the aftermath of it. And this is how I continued to fuck up in the moment. And it was like, yes, that feels so real and so honest. So personally, yeah. Thank you for that bit.
Yeah. And I think, you know, here's the thing too about writing a book called Professional Troublemaker, The Fear Fighter Manual. I had to lay myself out there too. For me, this is the most personal thing I've ever written. And I think that's why it's the best thing I've ever written, because we cannot just speak in abstract and think we are some guides if we don't show that we were there too and are there, right? I never call myself an expert at anything, because if I'm an expert, I'm not learning anything more. To call myself an expert is to say I've reached peak knowledge. And I pride myself on being a forever student. So I am always looking to learn more and be better.
One of the other things you bring up is the idea of being too much or too something. And you're not a huge fan of that too word. Tell me about that. How do we push back on this idea of being too much? And what does it mean?
I think being too much is a backhanded compliment or a backhanded insult, actually. It's a backhanded insult, because people don't want to act like they're insulting you. They'll just say you're too much, too loud, too aggressive, too sensitive, too quiet. Sometimes they'll call us too black, like too tall. And I'm always like, the thing that people will call you and say you're too it's only that when it's something that they can't use in the moment. And it usually is your superpower, that thing. A lot of people who were considered too mouthy as kids are now public speakers and writers and are now using our words to hit hearts and minds. I think people make these judgments about us. And I know I wrote a book called I'm Judging You.
And?
And I called that book that. I called that book that for a reason, because I was like, yes, we are all judging each other. The problem is that we're judging each other on the wrong things. We're judging each other on how tall we are, how dark we are, how queer we are, how Black we are. And instead of we should be judging each other on how are you showing up as a human being and making the world better, right? So when somebody says you are too something, they want to tell you to be less, but they don't want to say that. If they were to put that in the phrase of be less, you would be offended. But when they say you're too much, you internalize it. So I want us to stop internalizing people's judgments of us when they say we're too something. It's not for us to take on.
Yeah. Going back to this idea of being nice, being polite, one of the things that women, especially and femme-identified folks, especially get hung up on is money and not talking about money or not embracing money as a motivator for things. And you have such a refreshing take on that in this book about how money can be a motivator and that's okay. Can you talk a little bit about why don't we talk about it and why you think we should talk about it more beyond just negotiating for better pay? Because you talk about that too, which is incredibly important, but you go beyond that, which I appreciate.
Yeah, when we talk about money, I think money is a feminist issue. It's an economic justice issue. But we see money as greed when it comes to women. Women are not given permission to want to be wealthy or to be rich because we're told that we should be service-minded. But how can I be of service if I'm struggling? How can I be of service if I don't have the thing that drives the world, money? How can I give of my energy and my time if I lack money? If I can't feed my kids, if I can't pay my rent, if I wake up every day wondering where my next meal will come from. And then we're expecting women to basically skin ourselves for the world. And then men are allowed to show up and think about profit when we're always told to just think about purpose. I can't think about purpose if I'm making no profit. So money is an absolute feminist issue. Women should be allowed to make good money so we can be comfortable. Because when women make money, the world is better for it. Why? Because women use our money for philanthropy. Yes. We use our money for environmental justice. We use it to, we donate to nonprofits. We try to create funds to make the world better. The best way you can even look at this, Mackenzie Scott, Jeff Bezos' ex-wife, when they divorced, she instantly got $50 billion. Since then, Mackenzie has donated something like $10 billion. And I'm like, that woman having money, I want her to have more money than him.
Hell yeah.
Why? Because I trust how she would use the money better. So for us as women, we think being nice looks like always being of service. But here's the thing is we can't be of service if it's to our detriment. So I want us to learn how to ask for money. I want us to say, I deserve to be paid what I am worth more than what I even think I'm worth, because I'm probably already undervaluing myself. I want us to not attach guilt to wanting to build a prosperous life. Like, I know that the reason why I want to build wealth is because not only do I want to leave a legacy for my kids, but I also want to be able to wield that power for good. I trust what I would do if I showed up and got a $50 million. It's not going to be $50 million that I'm spending on my own home. It's not going to be $50 million I'm just spending on my family. I am somebody who is service-minded. So I would want to serve the world with that money. And most women would also do that. So let's get rich. Let's make money so then we can actually make this world better than we found it and be able to wield real power. Because as much as we want to just be people who are impact-driven people, if we don't have money, our impact is going to be limited. And that's real.
One of the goals, 2021 goals for Feminist Book Club. So we're a subscription box. We're an e-commerce company. We're a media company. We do a membership site, all of that stuff.
Yes. Get all of that.
Hell yeah. Is we want to find ways to disrupt capitalism? And like, how does that work? And so you have a critique of like the grind, and it's something that me as a business owner, I need to go back and like reread those chapters because I'm in the process of hiring more people and bringing on a team so we can have a healthy balance of profitability, rest, and participating in and disrupting capitalism at the same time. And so for you personally, running kind of this media empire, bringing on a team, can you just give advice to anybody, any entrepreneurs out there who are looking to participate in and disrupt capitalism at the same time?
Absolutely. Capitalism, all of this is so deeply interconnected. The programming that we've received in this world that tells us that we don't deserve joy and prosperity unless we have flailed ourselves for it. And even how we're expected to build businesses as entrepreneurs by ourselves. It's a trap. It's a trap. And for me, so I've been blogging on the internet. I've been blogging for 18 years, half my life.
Before we even called
Same. It blogging.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What up,
yeah.
LiveJournal?
What up, Zanga? Okay. Okay. Zanga. All right.
Yep.
We're totally dating ourselves. It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. It's fine. It's cool. Whatever. Okay. I'm washed. It's fine.
I'm pretty sure I read you back in like the
listen,
early
I probably read you. I was like, what? Yeah. You either pick between LiveJournal or Zanga. Pick your poison. Which one? Which one? Yep. Yep. You feel me? You are my tribe. Like, and I think, yeah, like it's hard to build our companies because we're also, you know, it's whole the ask of like, can we have it all? And we can't have it all at the same time if we're doing it all, right? And that which means do not feel guilt to outsource your life. I have laundry sent out at least once a week that I'm like, that's one less thing I have to do that does not serve me, that I don't enjoy doing, that can, if it buys me 3 hours back, what can I do with those 3 hours? And here's the thing is, I want us to also realize that like the goal is not to grind. That's not the goal. It's the means, right? It's not the end. Sometimes we might have to grind to build our companies up, to get our capital up, to get our revenue up. But we also have to be intentional about what does it look like for me to step away from the grind? How do I set up my life so the grind does not have to be a part of it for me to be prosperous? And that's why we have to diversify our income stream. So like the fact that you have the membership site, you got the box, I'm like, yes, yes, check, 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 check. Get all of the checks, okay? Because when you're building a company, when you're building something that is going to be big, like the empires that we're all trying to build, you're going to have to hand it over to people to help you run it. And don't feel the guilt of like, oh, but I should be able to do this. Are you a magician? Did you find 34 hours extra on top of the day? You know, people say things like Beyonce only has 24 hours a day. Beyonce herself wouldn't even tell you she got 24 hours in her day. Beyonce got 8 people who then add multiple hours to her day that allows her to create the empire. So we think we're supposed to be superhuman and be able to juggle 15 things at once equally well. And then we feel bad when a ball drops. Outsource your life. Please, like, I'm constantly trying to find other things that I can outsource. I'm like, okay, so laundry I can outsource. I might get a personal assistant. I already have an executive assistant. Like, it's just so much to do. And get the babysitter, you know, don't feel bad that the kids are being watched by the husband for a bit. You know, don't feel bad if you're like, hey, friend, can I just drop them off for 3 hours so I can get my brain back, right? Like, don't feel bad if you had to do takeout because you couldn't cook last night because you had no energy left. So all of that is just things that men never have to worry about. Capitalism tells them they have to show up and just use their brain, nothing else, right? They tell us we got to use our brain. We got to use our bodies. We got to use our beauty, right? And even that, then they tell us it's still not enough. And then we internalize that and say, you're right. I didn't do enough. I'm not enough. And then you feel guilty and then you can't even enjoy anything that you did work hard for. So listen, the grind of it all, let me tell you, I working for myself for a long time before I like really started building my company probably 6-7 years ago, man, listen, I was like, okay, I just got to do it all. I got to do it all. But let me tell you, there's no pride in the grind. What, you're going to tell somebody, oh my God, I worked really hard yesterday. Well, kudos to you. I didn't sleep. Yay. No, you don't, you're not getting the medal for not sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
You're like breaking yourself down. So we have to work against the grind culture. There's an account called The Nap Ministry.
Love them.
I love The Nap Ministry. I follow her, the Nap Bishop, Trisha Hersey Patrick, just to hear her say, you are enough rest. Her account is all about how the grind culture has been a way for capitalism to punish us all. And because of it, we are all suffering. Nobody's winning because of grind culture. And I love that. And I'm trying to take that in myself. And every single day I'm asking myself, what is a way that you can make your life easier today? What is something that you can put in place now that you will thank yourself for in 5 years? That means you can take a deep breath. You can rest more. You can sleep more. You can spend more time with those you love. So it's another intentional thing that I'm facing right now.
Well, that was a very selfish question from me, but I I imagine that I'm not the only one struggling with these things right now. And so I deeply appreciate that. And I hope our audience appreciates that as well. And we will link the Nap Ministry in the show notes, because that is a must follow.
Must.
Compulsory.
Yes.
Well, we are winding down our time, although I could talk to you for another couple of hours, but we do end with the same two questions, and they're easy. First is, where can we find you online if we want to keep in touch?
So I am all over these interwebs.
Yes, you are.
All over.
If you haven't been graced by Lovey's presence somewhere online, what are you doing with your social media, folks?
Listen, come look, my platform. I am at Lovey on all platforms, L-U-V-V-I-E, the one word. Okay. So Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I spend a lot of time on Instagram. It's probably where I spend most of my time because I enjoy how people engage on Instagram. I'm in Insta stories telling y'all stuff and doing trouble tales and unpopular opinions. I have my own social platform because I like to create work and spaces that I want to exist in. So when social media gets overwhelming, I wanted to have my audience have a place where they can retreat, where they know it's always going to be good. So Love Nation, L-U-V-V-N-A-T-I-O-N is my app and platform. It is a safe space in a dumpster fire world. They are amazing. There's 14,000 people. It's like 14,000 of the best people found themselves and put themselves in one space and they have a good time. And I do giveaways in there. I like will pop in there and bless them with all types of behind the scenes stuff that never shows up on my other platforms. And then, yeah, where else am I? My blog, awesomelylovey.com is where I am. It is the history of my work. It is where I'm updating. It is where I'm talking about the race, feminism, shenanigans. I love good times, television. I'm still mad at Game of Thrones and how they ended. Like, you know, so I'm so easy to find. I'm so easy to engage with. And I am, yeah, I'm everywhere.
Do you hear that? Did you hear that just now? That was everybody rushing to sign up to Love Nation.
Come on. Come.
It was so loud. It was just clamoring.
You heard it. They're just banging down the doors. We're ready for you. Just come in Love Nation. And when you need to ignore your aunt on Facebook and Instagram and whatever, and the random threads they're going to send you about, like, send this to 8 people, otherwise Jesus doesn't love you. Like, if you want to escape that, come into Love Nation. They call each other the love cousins. Everybody in Love Nation, they're the love cousins. So it is family affair, you know, they're smart, they're thoughtful, they're funny. So yeah, come on through.
So our final question is, do you have a book to recommend that is not one of your own?
Yes, yes. I always have a book to recommend. First of all, fun fact, my bookshelf is organized by color.
Very Instagrammable.
It's so Instagrammable. It's ridiculous. I'm like, I should probably just do it by genre, but it's cuter this way. I can't help myself. Okay. Everybody's going to know this already, but I have to, because it's just such an amazing book. Glennon Doyle's Untamed.
Really?
Whenever I'm writing my own books, I refuse to read other people's books because I don't want to take on their ideas and subconsciously put it on paper. When I was writing my book, Glennon's book came out. Glennon is one of my goodest friends. I refused to read it until I was done with my book. And let me tell you, best decision I could have made. Glennon Doyle is a writer's writer where her words like sing to you. And I remember I was reading her book in bed and I had to pick my phone up and I text her. I said, ma'am. ma'am.
How dare you?
How dare you? Who told you? I was like, girl. And it was, you know what's funny is her book and my book talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was reading it, she was like, yeah, no, that's why I was obsessed with your book. Because she was also texting me when she was reading my book. She was like, oh my God, I am obsessed. This is amazing. When I read her book, I was like, there is a reason they pay you the big bucks. Like there are some people who are authentically living in their gift. And the way Glennon Doyle writes definitely affirms that. Untamed is incredible. All the hype that people might have heard about Untamed is true. Absolutely true. It is not going to be a book that disappoints you. You're going to pick it up and be like, that's why it sold a million copies. It's incredible. So Glennon Doyle's Untamed.
So pick that up. We will link it in the show notes. We will link both of your books in the show notes, but make sure you pre-order Professional Troublemaker, The Fear Fighter Manual by Lovie Ajayi-Jones, because it is fantastic. It is the book I needed when I didn't know I needed it. You know how that just kind of happens? It just like falls into your lap and it was like, oh, fuck. Thank you.
Yes.
So
yes.
Thank you.
No, that's exactly. I love hearing that because I wrote that book because I needed it.
Yeah. Yeah. I desperately needed it like
yeah.
This week. And I'm so glad I powered through it this week because it was exactly the medicine that my heart needed.
Yes. That's what I want to hear. And honestly, like, I love getting that reflected back to me because it lets me know that like, if you needed to hear this, then millions of other people need to hear it. And it lets me know that this is the book that I wanted. Like I did what I wanted to do, which is to create the book that I needed in the moments when I'm not sure, in the moments when I need an extra push, in the times when I'm wondering whether I'm good enough or whether I should dare do that thing. So thank you for saying that. And I'm so glad it's helping you. And yeah, thank you for having me and sharing space with me.
You're so welcome. This has been such an honor. And everything we've talked about will be linked in the show notes. And get out there, buy this book.
Yes.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.